morning and welcome to the American Security Project. We're a nonpartisan think tank specializing in the strategic issues around national security. And one of those is economic security. And so today we're discussing the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. We'll also be live tweeting this at ASP TTIP. And we'll be recording this for video and audio and be on our website later today. We have two world experts on this issue. From the US perspective, we have Peter Rashish, who's had over 25 years engagement as a transatlantic policy entrepreneur. Most recently, he served as vice president for Europe and Eurasia at the US Chamber of Commerce, where he was a senior chamber official with responsibility for crafting and implementing strategies to promote the interests of chamber members in the transatlantic market. And we have Paul Adamson, who's the editor-in-chief and founder publisher of eSharp, a magazine on Europe and Europe's place in the world. He's also a senior European policy advisor at Covington and Burling. He is a member of RAND's European Council of Advisors and is on the advisory board of the polling think tank YouGov. Paul is also on the advisory group of British Influence, a new organization promoting UK's role in the European Union. So first of all, from the US perspective, I'll hand over to Peter.
Thanks, Paul. I'm very glad to be here this morning. Let me just make clear at the start that like Paul Adamson, I'm currently working as an advisor in a consulting firm, no longer representing the chamber, but glad to have done so until my current responsibilities. As I'm chairing the panel with Paul, who hails from the UK, I'm going to let myself be inspired at the beginning of my talk by the editors of The Economist magazine, who I understand regularly exhort their writers to simplify and exaggerate to make a point. So just at the very beginning, in that spirit, I want to start off with a small thought experiment. And I want to imagine a world where the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership has stalled. And it's late in 2016. The Congress was not able to pass trade promotion authority for the president because it was preoccupied with a lot of other issues we know about, healthcare, immigration, education, fiscal policy. But during those 3 years, of course, the world will not have stood still. And I like you to imagine these things that are happening during that period. First of all, we would see China gaining some traction with its own preferred vehicle for trade liberalization in Asia, the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, in the absence of progress on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which has also fallen victim to congressional inaction on trade. Then we'd see, of course, China's more state-dominated model of capitalism gaining increasing favor in the region. China is able to much more set standards in a number of areas, and we even see Russia knocking on the door of the regional partnership. In Europe, the EU is having trouble with its free trade agreement with Japan, which is its major strategic initiative in the region because of some reluctance in Japan to fully open its markets. The EU economy hasn't fully recovered from the financial crisis, and we even see its industrial base beginning to decline as companies move out because of rising energy costs, most part of which is brought upon by their inability to access either cheap gas or cheap oil from the United States. Meanwhile, and looking a little bit more in this hemisphere, Chile, Colombia, and Peru, who are part of the Pacific Alliance along with Mexico, are knocking on the door of NAFTA. But again, because it's an election year and because of this distaste for trade activism, they're not getting any response. U.S. economy remains strong, but companies are complaining about their inability to do business in Asia, which has become the most dynamic region in the world, because of increasing localization requirements, requirements to license IP, and things like that. And then we see, as the election is approaching, commentators from both the left and the right calling for a grand bargain between NAFTA and the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership in Asia. And we see that the US, Canadian, and Mexican leaders agree to meet after the election in order to find some ways to soften some of their existing free trade agreements in order to make NAFTA more palatable to the Chinese and the Russians and a number of others who are going to be in the RCEP. Now, I think that most of us would probably agree that this kind of world, with some exaggeration, I admit, I've sketched is not really a very favorable one for the United States and for the EU. But I do think that there's a lot of those, if not all of those elements, could come to pass, and maybe not in quite the compressed time frame I suggested, but they could happen were TTIP not to move forward. And the reason I say that is that I think, unlike any other trade agreement that the United States has entered into, TTIP is not only about creating the conditions for a more robust exchange of goods and services, but also about geoeconomics, about shaping the rules of global economic governance in a way that promotes U.S. national interests. And I think that the important thing is that the U.S. can't do this alone. It needs a large, economically advanced, and like-minded partner, such as the European Union, in order to pursue these interests. And I think that we're not, unfortunately, be able to do that, that pursue those kinds of interests in the short term anyway, within the World Trade Organization, because we did try that for about 10 years with the Doha round, and we found that the rise of the BRICS and other countries with different views of how to structure international economic relations made that very difficult. So I think that TTIP is, in many ways, a rational response by the EU and the US to this increasing diversity of the international economic system, and the idea being to set the rules together in a way that creates enough policy mass so that others will be convinced to come along and adopt the same approach. Now, I think that TTIP not only has a key role to play to help maintain and strengthen an open international economic system, but I think it also is a crucial, perhaps the leading element that the US currently has in its policy towards Europe overall. And while I would be cautious about calling TTIP an economic NATO, I think, you know, as international, as economic factors increasingly play a role in U.S. security, I think TTIP is an important test of whether the U.S. can modernize its relationship with Europe to keep up with this evolution. And I also think the U.S. success or failure in rebalancing its relationship with Europe in this way has implications for how the world sees the broader U.S. approach to international affairs. I think a retreat by the U.S. from trade, particularly with a long-standing strategic ally like Europe, could be interpreted, including by those who don't necessarily share all of our interests, as a sign that the U.S. is slowly disengaging from a leadership role globally. So despite this, what I see is this pretty strong geoeconomic case of getting TTIP done, what are some of the potential obstacles that negotiators and leaders need to look out for? I think that for both the US and the EU, there's a need to prevent what Freud called the narcissism of minor differences from keeping our eye on the big picture. While the US and the EU do have legitimate differences on trade, I think what divides the two sides of the Atlantic is really minor compared to what unites their interests. But while these differences may be minor in a relative sense, they can reflect deeply held values, traditions, historical, cultural preferences, and other things. So, for example, a number of interest groups in the EU are strongly against importing U.S. beef produced with hormones or GMO corn. In the U.S., we're reluctant to allow Europeans to we're reluctant to give up our ability to use certain names like champagne or parmesan, and we don't look favorably on the idea of European ships making deliveries between U.S. ports. So I do think whether the U.S. and the EU can find ways to resolve or bridge or finesse these issues, it is important because of the precedent that TTIP will set for other trade negotiations. Now, it's also clear that in the U.S., TTIP has become ensnared in this broader debate we're seeing about jobs and inequality. I mean, there's a number of views about, you know, how much trade has really contributed to equality in the United States, if at all. But I think it's frankly hard to see how greater trade with Europe could, which is a high wage economy, really will have any measurable effect on wages. In fact, I think the contrary may be true, because first, if you look at the fact that take a look at the fact that jobs linked to exports in the United States and in firms owned by foreign investors pay higher wages than purely domestic firms. And as Europe is our number one export market for goods and our number one foreign investor, I think that more trade with Europe should actually help with that issue. Second, it's possible, depending on how a trade agreement is written with Europe, that U.S. companies may decide, rather than to invest in Europe, to export from Europe, because now they won't have any tariff barriers. And if that's the case, you'd again have more high-paying export jobs in the United States. And the third thing is that 40% of trade between the United States and Europe is between the same company, and a very large remaining portion is between companies in the same industry. And so that means that there's a logic in these transatlantic supply chains which would argue for keeping those jobs in the United States. And I just think it's really highly unlikely that trade with Europe would lead to shipping jobs overseas. But trade, as I think in the U.S., has also become entangled with threats that people perceive about, you know, U.S. international engagement more broadly. You know, the U.S. does engage in a number of different ways with abroad, so to speak, through the IMF, the World Bank, the G20, and other fora. But those places are mostly concerned with sort of broader, less focused macroeconomic issues like currencies and austerity versus stimulus, and those bodies are much more consultative than a trade agreement would be. And a trade agreement tends to have a kind of immediate binding consequences for U.S. policy in a way that those other fora don't. And I think that's all the more true as what we call 21st century trade deals are about more than just removing tariffs, but also about trying to align approaches to regulatory policy in a way that can very much impinge on domestic policy. And I think this has particularly been a concern in Europe, which sees itself as having more stringent health and safety and environmental standards in the United States. And there's sort of a fear that somehow through TTIP, those standards may come down. Now, there's one issue in the United States and in Europe which has gained a lot of attention lately. I don't want to go into too many details about it, but it is something that I think negotiators have to look at seriously, and that's this issue of what we call investor-state dispute settlement, ISDS. It's something that is in thousands, or at least, you know, over 1,000 trade agreements worldwide, and what it does, it provides for independent tribunals where companies can bring complaints about unfair treatment, and it not only helps... It not only gives companies a sort of extra level of protection, but it also helps especially developing countries who are trying to attract investment for their own economic progress, but who don't have the kind of legal infrastructure that some more advanced countries do. And with ISDS, companies feel much more secure about going into those countries where the legal system isn't as advanced. Now, I think that if the U.S. and the EU agree on TTIP, they're going to absolutely make sure that any kind of investor protection agreement they sign is going to give room for both the U.S. and the EU to make and maintain any kinds of policies or regulations that they feel are important for domestic social interests. But it has become controversial because of a couple of cases. There's one where Australia was sued about its plain packaging on cigarettes under its FTA with free trade agreement with Hong Kong. And then in Germany, a Swedish company sued Germany after Germany decided to move away from nuclear energy. And so these two cases who knows how they'll turn out. In most cases usually go against investors, but those cases have kind of highlighted the issue. You know, on the one hand, I think that because the US and the EU have very strong levels of legal protection, investors are likely to feel comfortable, continue to feel comfortable, investing in the U.S. and the EU after TTIP. On the other hand, while I wouldn't want to have any one issue be the, make or break one for TTIP, it is possible that if we don't have some kind of investor protection in TTIP, that it could be harmful for both U.S. and EU interests in future trade negotiations. So let me just conclude with a few thoughts on bipartisanship and trade policy. But to do so, let me read two quotes. The first one goes as follows. A strong comprehensive trade and investment agreement with the EU has the potential to create significant good-paying jobs for American workers. Negotiations will not be easy, but they have enormous potential to open new opportunities for us to sell our goods and services in the EU. I welcome the president's movement forward on this effort and look forward to consulting closely with the administration. That's the first one. Second one goes like this. If well negotiated with the goal of increasing employment and well-being for working families, using the transatlantic free trade agreement to increase market access to Europe with its highly industrialized nations and large middle class could positively affect that trade balance and create jobs in the US by increasing net exports. Now, to my mind, those two statements communicate the same message, was that with TTIP, we'll increase US export opportunities and create jobs at home. Okay, so here's the punchline. The first one is from Congressman Dave Camp, who's the Republican chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee. And the second one is from the AFL-CIO, the leading US union, in its contribution to a consultative process on TTIP. So while differences over TTIP do exist between the Republicans and Democrats and between the business community and labor, I think what these two quotes show is that with some goodwill, flexibility, and political leadership both from both parties, there's more than enough common ground to find a majority for TTIP in the US Congress. Finally, I think a strong objective case can be made that the arc of international economic policy within the Democratic Party bends distinctively towards Europe. After World War II, the Truman administration launched the Marshall Plan, perhaps the single most effective use of economic tools to further US foreign policy interests in our history. It created the conditions for economic cooperation with Europe and thus for the creation of the common market, which later became the EU. In 1962, the Kennedy administration passed the Trade Expansion Act to promote trade with Europe, combining the commercial goal of keeping the emerging European Union's markets open with the strategic goal of fostering greater international economic policy cooperation between the US and Europe, what Kennedy called a declaration of interdependence. After the Cold War, when the old glue of fighting communism had disappeared, the Clinton administration launched the very forward-looking new transatlantic agenda with the EU, providing for a wide range of avenues for cooperation with the EU. And now we have the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, which for the first time would provide a treaty basis for the economic relationship between the US and the EU. And like the 1962 Trade Expansion Act, the TTIP would also serve the twin goals of open markets and transatlantic leadership in the global economy. Now, in 1962, 75% of Democrats in the House of Representatives voted in favor of the Trade Expansion Act, and 54% of Republicans. We're probably not going to see that kind of configuration for TTIP, but if the Democrats remain true to their heritage of international economic engagement with Europe, and along with the already strong Republican Party support for trade agreements, TTIP can become a major bipartisan achievement in the next few years. Thank you.
Peter, thanks very much. And Paul, from the EU side.
Thank you, Paul. First of all, thank you for inviting me, and thank you to your organization for hosting this. Thank you all for being in the room. I'm not sure I would have got up on a cold, snowy winter morning this early to listen to myself speak, that's for sure. But thank you for being here. Well, first things first. I mean, Peter, as always happens when you're a first speaker, has covered a lot of the ground. But first things first, I would suggest TTIP, first of all, is not a trade agreement, free trade agreement. It's certainly not a classic, traditional free trade agreement, or it's much more than a free trade agreement. And I say that because a lot of people out there kind of think they know what they're talking about. And it's strange because on one hand, you have the trade specialists, the free trade specialists, who almost by definition are in favor of free trade, not willfully, but slightly unwittingly maybe, distorting the debate at the outset by talking about TTIP as a classic FTA. With issues also about multilateralism, whether TTIP is undermining the multilateral system, etc. Then the other side, you have the broad anti-coalition globalization groups who are anti-free trade anyway. And both groups, in a strange way, fail to appreciate, maybe different degrees of nuance, obviously, the fact that, as I say, TTIP is not just a trade agreement. And I'm insisting a bit sort of heavily on that without just being pedantic, because it actually affects also the way we talk about the discussions. I mean, as you know, TTIP is about, yes, obviously, as Peter was saying, removal of certain tariffs, and even if they're quite low, they're still worth removing even further or reducing even further, because there are huge economic gains to be accrued by doing so. But at the same time, it is all about essentially the meat and potatoes. Chapter 2 of TTIP is all about regulatory convergence, not reducing maybe regulations willy-nilly, but just some kind of common sense approach to at least recognizing each other's existing standards, maybe in the medium term trying to converge, and in the long term just cooperating before they even become standards in the first place. Whether or not they're exported to the rest of the world is another debate maybe we have to address on some other occasion. It does affect the language, it seems to me, because, you know, trade agreements are all about negotiation, about compromises, about give and take. I'll give you this and you give me that. You can quantify these so-called concessions. And it's all about tit for tat, maybe, or, you know, give and take and all that kind of stuff. And if you're not careful, very soon the whole debate is hijacked on the back of that kind of received, not just received wisdom, it's like a received lexicon that people have. And it's understandable because people talk about free trade much more than they talk about regulatory convergence, that's for sure. But I think it's important that we remind ourselves that TTIP is not to be discussed in those classic parameters, I would suggest. And certainly on the regulatory side, it's not about negotiation, about car safety standards or whatever. You don't negotiate on brakes in cars. It's just a question of common sense approach to see, hopefully recognizing each other's important standards. So that's maybe, I'd like to make that very clear, maybe too much so at the outset. Now, the critics of TTIP, of course, and there are very many out there, are quite clear in their minds why they're against TTIP. Important reason, but it's still an important reason for them, is that they think the benefits, the so-called benefits, the alleged benefits are exaggerated. And it's true, there may be, and I'm obviously, like Peter, may be obviously pro-TTIP, but at the same time, there's an element, maybe a hubris, maybe the pro-TTIP community in all the different formulations are slightly guilty of overstating the importance. But in their defense, they were just referred to quite a large number of independent studies which have been commissioned by various people. Well, you might say, yes, if you commission a study and you're paying for it, then maybe you're trying to influence the eventual outcome of those studies. But, you know, there's a lot of stuff out there by various think tanks, economic consultancies, who are independent, who would show the clear benefits. I mean, I agree exactly on the quantum, on some of the detail, but there are clear benefits, I would suggest, to there. But it's not quite as high as has been alleged by certain pro-TTIP groups. They're still important. And certainly it's not an attempt to willfully mislead people about the benefits. Secondly, it's a massive exercise, the critics say it's a massive exercise in deregulation, whether it's for environment, consumers, or labor standards. Well, you know, if you're going back to the European Union, you could say the European Union single market is a massive exercise in deregulation because deregulation defined as reducing the number of regulations. Because the whole thesis of the European Union single market, of course, is to replace 28 different laws or standards with one single European-wide law or standard. So I think this is slightly simplistic, and both sides of the pond who are involved in the negotiations are at great pains to stress, with some success but not total success, obviously, that this is not an exercise in lowering safety standards for consumers or whatever. It is not that at all, but obviously that's an issue to be addressed going forward as we talk about the kind of the public diplomacy involved around trying to promote TTIP for the different groups who are very cynical, if not antagonistic, to the whole thing. And then maybe finally, it's very untransparent, people say. Because partially going back to my earlier remarks about it, seen as a trade agreement, and trade agreements traditionally negotiated behind closed doors without any kind of outside involvement, certainly not lights and cameras taking note of everything that's being said. But I think the trade people involved, whether it's USTR here or DG Trade and European Commission in Brussels, I would argue maybe, and there must be quite a culture shock for them, for both sides, making enormous efforts to engage with the outside world, to release whatever information they can at appropriate moments, have debriefings after every round with stakeholders, civil society groups, and to basically try and keep them abreast of what's going on. Helped also by the European Parliament here, and I'm sure maybe I'm not sure what's happening stateside, but in terms of monitoring groups and regular appearances by key policymakers at the Trade Committee and other groups of the European Parliament to tell people what's going on and open debates and discussions, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I think the issue there, of course, is that it's never enough for some people who are adamant, who are determined not to approve a TTIP at whatever happens, no matter what these negotiators do, it seems to be never enough. But I think bit by bit, they have to realize that enormous steps have been made. The latest manifestation, by the way, and it may seem like window dressing to cynics, but then cynics will always be cynics, is the creation on our side of the Atlantic of a kind of advisory forum composed of different parts of civil society, business groups, consumer groups, environmental groups, labor groups, etc., to be a kind of advisory group to the European Commissioner and the Commissioner for Trade, Karl de Gucht. And then it's just the general view, right? It's a big business agenda, and I'll come back to that in a second. So I think that certainly more has to be done, not so much by the the negotiators and the regulators, but the people outside who believe in TTIP to make the case for TTIP. I mean, relatively speaking, although things are finally starting to move in the right direction from a pro-TTIP point of view, is that big business, you want to call it big business, is starting to speak up about the time, I think Carl De Gucht and Mike Frommer would say. I think that's an open secret. They have a certain frustration that big business, and I say when I say big business, I mean CEOs of companies, people who actually represent, who are ambassadors for their companies, should speak out on public and public arenas, not just privately, to make the case, even just from their own company or for their own sector's perspective. If I were to be critical of kind of the world I'm more familiar with, is that more needs to be done there, more case studies, more data, specific stuff. There's a lot of sort of meta, you know, micro data about there, about the, you know, 0.9% GDP, whatever type benefit. But that doesn't really mean very much to ordinary people, including myself. What does that mean in terms of jobs, in jobs and growth? So I think that has to be addressed more. More CEOs speak out. And my experience as CEOs is that nobody wants to be the first CEO to speak out, but once one or two speak out, then they kind of, they come along. Briefly on small businesses, given that, I mean, we all know anyway that jobs and growth tend to come from small businesses, not large corporations, frankly, and it's more difficult for maybe small businesses to take the time, energy, have the energy to make the case. They're too busy running a small business. And a lot of small businesses necessarily do not maybe export across the Atlantic. They're too small for that, but they are subcontracted. They may make parts of a car or something, which from, say, Poland to Germany, which in turn, to a large corporation, a car manufacturer, for example, in Germany, which in turn exports to the United States. So I think that way also the small business concerns can be addressed. Since towards the end, luckily for me, Peter explained what ISDS means, so you all know now, as much as I do, about what investor state dispute systems and mechanisms actually mean in practice. But just on the point of information, it is, unfortunately, the one issue, given a lot of relative ignorance. I don't mean that in a particularly critical way, but people seem to think, as I said at the beginning, that they know what TTIP's about. It's one of those trade deals that, you know, you're either for or against. And as I'm trying to explain, and Peter's intervention helped enormously, it's much more than that. It's much more multi-layered, much more sophisticated than that. Nonetheless, people are determined, if they don't like the idea, not to like the idea. And the civil society groups have been very assiduous in trying to maybe identify an issue around which if they're anti-TTIP, to coalesce and be critical of. And ISDS, this rather obscure, arcane thing that a lot of us didn't know existed until recently, has become this totemic issue around which people can coalesce. And as Peter said, there are about 1,400 of these things out there. They've been around for several decades. Whether that makes it even more sinister or less, or whether it's more benign because it's been around a long time, or even worse because it's actually been around much longer than we realize, is a matter of a debate. But it's not a brand new thing, certainly being introduced through the back door of TTIP, that is for sure. And it's slightly disingenuous to suggest that kind of activity. It is not the case. And the European Commission, and then I think it's quite, again, in this idea about being more responsive to people's concerns and finding mechanisms to engage with people who have concerns, have, in a sense, as you know, called time out on ISDS for the moment. They haven't said stop the clock on the whole negotiations as a whole, but they have said on the specific aspect of ISDS, which is important, we'll have a three-month consultation in Europe, in Brussels, starting next month. It's starting soon. You can go online and track it yourselves, obviously, if you're interested, and make submissions. It remains to be seen what the European Commission will do with the information, but at least what they receive from the outside world, but at least it gives everybody an opportunity outside the discussions, who are not part of the machinery, to make their views heard. And I think that's, you know, you may say it's a political window dressing. Okay, if you're cynical again, you'll always find reason to be cynical. But I think it is, on the other side, a reasonably legitimate attempt by Carl De Gucht and his team to address those concerns, because, you know, DG Trade is worried that this issue could blow up and hijack the whole process. I think that's an issue to take into account and give some credit to the institutions for doing that. Finally, I think it's now, as De Gucht said last week, he was here in town, I think it was last week, meeting Mike Frommer. And he says now that the serious work starts. You know, we're into the third round, kicks off. I think it's the third round, might be the fourth round. In a couple of weeks' time, back in Brussels, Frommer and De Gucht have just had their famous stock taking, you know, as a kind of audit about where we stand on both sides, but now they realize that all the initial fluffery and discussion about the broad principles, that time has come and gone. And now we have to talk about some controversial issues where we do not agree. And one sticking point clearly going forward will be the inclusion of financial services or not in TTIP. And that's going to be a real sticking point, seems to me. And then we have, you know, two important events for people like us who live in Brussels. First of all, a gentleman called President Obama is coming to Brussels on the 25th of March. He'll be doing a lot of official stuff and maybe also a speech to real people outside the bubble, as it were. And that, I think it'd be inconceivable he won't talk about TTIP in some shape or form. And on a smaller note, but important, we have our new ambassador, US ambassador to the European Union, arriving in mid-March. So he'll be a useful, hopefully, champion of TTIP to make the case as well on public platforms. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So we're going to open it for Q&A. If you raise your hand, we have a microphone available to come. All I need you to do is tell me your name and your affiliation. But first of all, I'll ask the first question. You both talked about the geopolitical nature of TTIP and these type of deals. Over the last week and a half, going back a while now, we saw Ukraine and the revolution that has happened in Ukraine based around a trade political agreement either between the EU and Russia. How do you feel that this fits into the wider agreement and the wider negotiations we're seeing?
Well, I think that the TTIP is absolutely going to have repercussions for, in the first phase at least, the key trading partners of both the U.S. and the EU. So, you've already, just to take one example of that, you already have seen the U.S. and Turkey set up a high-level committee to talk about what TTIP will mean for U.S.-Turkish economic relations. The U.S. and the EFTA countries, Switzerland, Liechtenstein, Norway, and Iceland, have also set up a bilateral coordinating group on TTIP. And more informally, I think there's been some, you know, discussions about what TTIP would mean for NAFTA. And so I think that whatever the U.S. and the EU do together is clearly being watched. And I think that while Ukraine is not has not developed the same kind of economic relationship with the U.S. or with the EU in this case, than maybe some of the others I mentioned, I think over the long term, if TTIP is successful, it gives the U.S. and the EU somewhat more leverage internationally, and you know may on Ukraine and a number of other issues increase their ability to put forward their preferred solutions.
I would answer it slightly a different way, in the sense that what we haven't discussed maybe too much at the beginning, Peter and I, is this is supposed to be a jobs and growth agenda. There's enormous political capital devoted to this exercise, so it's almost like it's too big to fail type thing. Because it's to show that the U.S. can sort of get their act together, having announced this stuff with great fanfare, and if they can't deliver in some shape or form, that'll be at the very least embarrassing, if not to say catastrophic. And secondly, it is about creating wealth and prosperity and jobs for young people in our two regions. And so I think before we can start being too proud almost about and assertive about what the US and the EU can do for regions like Ukraine through trade deals and certain loans and cash injections, we have to be able to promote our own economies as well. And I think that is an important issue as well. Secondly, the whole point where people might feel slightly excluded, maybe not the case of Ukraine yet, because that's a special case, but if you're other parts of the world thinking, well, why can't we join this thing, a bit like Japan joining TPP in the later stages of TPP, when I think that mechanisms are going to be created, that are already conceived, through which other regions can be part of this TTIP. They may have to change the name of TTIP to something else, obviously, but it is not supposed to be an exclusive, rich old West boys club exercise, that's for sure.
Thank you so much. I'll take questions from the audience. If you just raise your hands.
Alex Racy, American University. In light of the roughly 400,000 jobs that TTIP is projected to create in Europe. Around 110,000 of those would be in Germany. So considering this statistic, do you see the EU having to, or should the EU undertake any strategies to foster more equal job creation in the new member states, such as Romania, Bulgaria, and Croatia, in light of the TTIP agreement being facilitated?
Yeah, that's for you, Paul.
Should have done 110 or 111 or 112,000 jobs. You seem very precise. To answer your question seriously, I think there's an issue there for the European Union in trying to demonstrate in clear ways the benefits of TTIP on our side of the Atlantic. Because you have here studies like the Atlantic Council Bertelsmann study, which is going to be even further apparently developed, which shows, state by state, right, here, the benefits, economic benefits, quite precisely, and look at their ideas to drill down further into congressional districts. Now, the European Union, I think it's not a secret either, is reluctant to engage in a similar exercise because, as you're suggesting in your question, the benefits are not evenly spread across all 28 member states. That's a reality, that's for sure. I think, frankly, that to a certain extent, and that's not because of TTIP or any kind of trade deal, people go, it's not a new phenomenon now, people go where the jobs are. And in a funny and a strange way, part of the success of the European Union, part of its objective, of course, is to foster free movement of people. Some people may want to, do not like the idea of leaving their home country or even town to find work, but you do go where, whether you're immigrants 100 years ago or now, you go where the jobs are if you have the skills. But I think, maybe you clearly know more about it than I do because your question was so specific, but my earlier point about often small businesses can benefit from TTIP if they are subcontractors to larger corporations who then export. So I think some of the methodology going forward has to address that specific. You may not be exporting to the United States if you're a small business in Romania, for example, but if you're supplying a German manufacturer, then somewhere you are benefiting from, who then exports to the US, you are benefiting from TTIP, I would suggest.
Thank you. Question?
Hello, Stephen Kokoris, American Hellenic Institute. Thank you for coming. In 2010, there was a large natural gas reserve discovered off the south coast of Cyprus, and Noble Gas, an American company, actually joined with Cyprus to create a venture in the region, despite a lack of cooperation from Turkey, an American ally. What can the U.S. and the EU do to ensure that Cyprus's economic exclusive zone doesn't get violated as the natural gas is being excavated and traded throughout the EU and other places?
Well, I can't address that directly through the lens of TTIP, but I can say that broadly speaking in energy policy, right now, I think TTIP can contribute to a better atmosphere on energy policy in this way. Currently, the U.S. can only export natural gas to countries with which it has a free trade agreement, and it cannot export crude oil at all. I mean, I think it's legitimate goal that the two sides together should try to see how we can liberalize trade in both directions on all aspects of energy policy. If we have a free trade agreement through TTIP, then we would be able to export natural gas to Europe. The issue of oil exports is all caught up in the last oil crisis, but I think that the more we can promote a free flow of natural resources across the Atlantic, the better. And I think if we do so, that may in some way have a spin-off effect to create a better atmosphere in other regions for energy trade.
Yeah, it's not my specialist subject, so I can't give you a very specific answer. More broadly, and finally, Peter referred to in his introductory remarks, whether or not you refer to TTIP as an economic version of NATO, and I've heard security and foreign policy people talking about we need to have a TTIP for energy and for security and foreign policy. So the two sides seem to be sort of not at cross purposes. They're looking at each other's side to see whether they can collaborate. And I just think that maybe in the broader debate about cooperation on security, whether it's in NATO or even through the United European Union, this issue is going to be central now. As you know much better than I do, there's an opportunity now, which is a small window for various people who traditionally do not talk to each other, to finally, on the back of this energy development, to come together and work something out.
Thank you.
Hi, Rudy Patel from the Kyle House Group. I was just hoping to press you a bit more on the financial services piece, and in terms of what you feel is a, you know, whether you feel like it would make TTIP stronger, weaker, what makes it a sticking point?
If you know this, forgive me for telling you what you know, but as we stand, my understanding is that for the inclusion of financial services, you have member state governments, including my own government, United Kingdom, you have the financial services industry in Europe, and you have the financial services industry in the United States. On the other side, you have the US Treasury and the USG broadly, who are against the inclusion of financial services. I gave some little slightly mischievous advice at a parliamentary group last week, which I actually meant sincerely, but it came out maybe rather facetious, is that all the submissions made by those in favor of the inclusion of financial services start with almost the same sentence. We are not promoting this in an attempt to undermine Dodd-Frank. And I suggested that the people, they should stop saying that, because the more they say it, the more suspicious people seem to be about their intentions. So maybe stop saying it for the moment, and because people just say, you keep saying it, so why do you keep saying it? You must mean the opposite, sort of counterintuitively. I know nothing about the impact per se. Obviously, the people who are pro think it would be a fantastic idea. The only advice I give the proponents of the inclusion of financial services is to maybe bide their time slightly, wait for, if they're not getting much traction at the moment, because the US Treasury and the government generally are not keen to shift, and they would argue rightly so on this. We'll wait for a moment, wait to see what benefits accrue from other chapters in TTIP as they start becoming more successful, and use those arguments to come back in some future date too, because there's still plenty of time for that. Trying to just sort of get financial services included at the very beginning seems to me, given the lack of success so far, seems to be not working, and therefore just bide their time and come back in the medium term.
Yes.
Can you hear me?
There's a mic on the
microphone.
Having served in Congress, when you talk to Republicans, they think of the European Union as very bureaucratic. And so any compromise with the European Union will mean there'll be more regulation in the United States. And so you have sort of this feeling that negotiations are not going to go well for less regulation. So you try to find an argument that will surmount the idea of Republicans talking about European being bureaucratic or socialistic. And then with Democrats, they're always fear about losing jobs. And as Peter mentioned, the AFL-CIO had a good quote there, but I don't know, besides the political quote, it might not be the realism of what they would willing to negotiate. So the point I mentioned to both of you, and so it's sort of a two-point question. One is the possibility of using as an incentive a new negotiation for data security and data protection, as well as privacy between the United States and Europe, would be an incentive for both countries to come together with this negotiation. And then, Peter, you mentioned sort of obliquely the idea of an economic NATO concept. And that appeals to me, but you're saying there's some negative connotation to an economic NATO. So the two questions are, one, can we use the idea of what happened with Snowden as a way to bring us together to protect consumers, and two, the term economic NATO is negative for why?
Thanks, Congressman. Let me try to answer that. What concerns me about the term economic NATO is that I think that, superficially at least, when people hear that, they think they do, you know, right, they go right back to what NATO was. And NATO was founded when there were, when we didn't just have a competitor slash partner on the economic level, which is the European Union, and frankly, fully a partner on a number of foreign and security policies. It was founded in order to defend ourselves against what was pretty much an enemy, the Soviet Union. And I think that calling it an economic NATO, I hope it does. What I'm concerned about is it might sort of make trade look like it's a zero sum. You have, you know, one side against the other side, and who is it that the U.S. and EU are fighting against the way we fought against communism? And that's, I think, an unhealthy way to look at trade, because even with our, even with countries with whom we may not share certain values about how we should, say, how, what kind of regulations we ought to have, how much we should respect intellectual property, even countries like that can be our partners in so many ways on trade. So I would hate to see trade sort of be escalated into this concept of somehow for or against. That's really what concerns me about the terminology.
On the data question, it's funny, we've been here almost three quarters of an hour and haven't mentioned NSA on surveillance. Extraordinary. Sorry about that, Pete. Or maybe you were hoping we'd just spontaneously refer to it. But now, thanks to the congressman, we can do so. I think, without overstating it, hopefully, for the American audience, let's not underestimate the impact the revelations have had in Europe. We were shocked. Maybe the Brits a bit more sanguine, because we're supposed to be complicit anyway. So we'd be hypocritical to be too outraged, because we're part of the problem, allegedly, as opposed to part of the solution. But more seriously, you know, certain countries like Germany, for obvious historical reasons, are kind of, you know, worried about that. And it's not going to go away anytime soon, simply because, you know, the strategy of Mr. Snowden and his colleagues is to drip feed this stuff, right? Every, you know, just when you think the story has died away, then something else come, you know, is published. And so it's not going to. So it's very difficult, maybe, to find a way to tackle that. And it is a backdrop to TTIP, whether or not data flows and all that ecosystem is formally part of TTIP negotiations is secondary. It is the backdrop against which we hold, conduct these negotiations. And it is something we need to be certainly very mindful of and not be dismissive of. So maybe one can make a more robust case for the issues of data collection because we're living in this very uncertain and dangerous world. And maybe that hasn't been done as well as it might have been done in the past, but could be addressed in the future. And I can't imagine a speech by President Obama in Brussels next month not taking some, you know, some time off to be more conciliatory and more constructive, certainly to a European audience.
Any questions?
Hi, I'm Meryl Dekker from the Economic Division of the Dutch Embassy. My question is regarding consumer health and safety. In Europe, we have the precautionary principle, and in the US, a more scientific approach as to allowing goods on the market and under what condition. To what extent do you think that both parties are likely to meet in the middle, or to what extent do you think they will choose either one or the other approach regarding consumer health and safety in the TTIP negotiations?
I would, first of all, I would take issue. I don't think it's going to be an either or, and if it were to be, it'd be suicidal. So it's not going to be, I would question the language of your question. It's not going to be a binary, you know, mutually exclusive choice between one or the other. Secondly, if you press, if I were a European civil servant listening to that, I would say people, I'm fed up of being told the precautionary principle is non-science-based, you're inferring. And they say up to point the precautionary principle is science-based. I'm not an expert on that, so I can't make any judgment. But I think that the lesson going forward is that both sides have to be a bit more cognizant of the other person's position, obviously. I don't think it's an either-or necessarily. In political, if you like, strategic, almost public relations terms, the balance but the pro-TTIP groups are how to obviously to address this issue, otherwise a lot of progress will not be made, clearly, as you suggest in your question. But also it's a way also to kind of, the existence of the precautionary principle with all its, you know, elements is one way, of course, to reassure some of the groups out there who may be anti-TTIP that, you know, TTIP is not such a bad thing, because if the precautionary principle is sustained, then all the safeguards in place will remain in place. So it's a difficult balance to strike.
Can I add to that? you know, to the extent that the U.S. and the EU can find ways to agree on certain of these issues, and some of them may be more difficult, but certainly there are going to be ones where we see things similarly, even if there are a few that divide us. If that's the case, that means that we can try to recognize how the other one does things. It reduces, and say a company only has to get something tested once, that reduces the workload on either the US or the European regulators, and that means that the US and European regulators then have more resources that they can devote to exports coming into their countries, which are really problematic, where they're countries which really don't have good systems for looking after consumer health and safety. So I think we have to, sure, recognize that there may be a few areas we don't agree, also recognize there are going to be a lot of areas where we do agree, which are going to then allow us to have cost savings and then to protect consumers by focusing on the problem markets.
And we've got time for one more question.
My name is Jeffrey Harris. I'm here with my colleague Helena, who knows a lot more about the TTIP from the European Parliament Liaison Office with the Congress. And just a short, slightly counterintuitive question. Mightn't it be better if the TTIP sort of went out of the news for a while, and that after the European elections and the midterm elections, then when there's more progress to report, hopefully, then the debate sort of starts again, because at the moment the debate is about something theoretical and on very, very big issues, totally different positions are being expressed. So that's a question. How realistic is that, if it were to be a good idea? Do the speakers give us any indication, would they expect TTIP to be a big issue in the European election or in the midterm elections coming up in the coming months as well?
Midterms first.
On the elections, much of the even though some, you know, those of us who think that transatlantic relations are the be-all and end-all of politics, I'd be surprised if TTIP is much of a focus right now. Partly for what you say, because its negotiations are ongoing, positions have not really matured that much. I think that trade more broadly could well be an issue in the elections. And there, it's interesting because you're going to have some Democrats on the left of the party who are going to differ with apparently, in some least for the moment, have see some things different, at least on the timing of trade with the president. And then you have also noticed that among some of the Tea Party representatives that there is some concern about sovereignty, the Congress handing over sovereignty to the president. There's some concern also on the investor-state dispute settlement issue. So you may see trade be a part of the election. I would be surprised if TTIP specifically, sort of really shakes up any particular election. But I and on the question of should it be sort of put on the back burner, I think that's going to happen. Anyway, I think you're right that when positions are riper, then we'll see a lot more people standing up, saying what they really think. But I do think that we can't just bring out of hibernation. I think that it's if someone thinks it's important, I think it's worth keeping it at least on a low burn.
From the European election.
Well, actually, I'm not sure, Jeff, to what extent it is we're talking about it too much. I talk about it too much. I hold my hand up, and I'm becoming a bit of a TTIP fetishist, and I need to maybe calm down a bit. And once or twice, all these newsletters and stuff, and you think, my God, the whole world is TTIP-focused. And maybe it's not quite as TTIP-focused as some of us might like to think. But it's a judgment call as well, because one of the concerns, as you know, certainly when TTIP was first launched, was how to maintain momentum, right? Political interest and all that kind of stuff. And part of the challenge, certainly at the beginning of the launch of TTIP several years ago, was to find ways to make sure people just didn't lose interest. As it becomes rather boring and detailed and technical, that people then just don't switch off and the negotiators go off in their little corner and negotiate, but then the political momentum, which is important to unblock rather arbitrary blockages needs to be there for that very purpose. So it's a very difficult one to find a balance. Certainly, I think in the short to medium term, businesses should be speaking up more, And then they can maybe, once they made their case, they can maybe be allowed to go back to running their corporations. On the elections, very briefly, on the European election, I wouldn't dream to talk about the Congress. I would like to think that the obvious, maybe the conventional wisdom is if people want to talk about TTIP at all on the campaign trail for the European Parliament election, which is maybe in itself rather unlikely, they will talk about it in negative terms and say it's anti-globalization, we hate the whole thing. But it'd be quite nice to think, without being too naive, that you know certainly certain members and candidates on the centre-left of the spectrum might talk about TTIP in a positive way because it's about jobs and growth. That might be slightly you know, pie in the sky, but I would urge certain any centre-left candidates I know fighting elections in May to think about using that kind of language.
Well, this has been a very interesting discussion. And we've certainly raised some non-boring and non-technical issues in this. So if you join me in thanking our speakers. Please check out our website for our further events going forward next month. Thank you so much.